So am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review,
welcome to Review Away, everybody. It's a very special edition of the show. I'm joined not only by Wei Ting.
Yes.
But we're joined in studio by Japanese authority, W.H. Park. And W.H., welcome to the beautiful Review Away studios here in downtown Toronto.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have known W.H., I would say, for a good 10 years now. Someone that I met when I was just a young teenager at O'Grady's. And I will attribute pretty much everything I know to the Japanese wrestling scene to this man. And when we were going to review the Super Jacob 94 way, I thought this would be the perfect time to have WH back here, well, for the first time, to chat about this historic event.
Yes, because honestly, I don't know if we would be able to pull it off. You know, we've never really done a Japanese show before on Review Away.
So before we can make any mistakes that everyone online will jump on us for, WH will be here to correct any issues and add a unique insight here to this very, very big event. And I just wanted to start off, WH, by for those that might not be familiar with you, just tell us a bit about kind of what you're watching these days and kind of how you got into the whole Japanese wrestling scene, whether it be tape trading or online, however it was.
God, I think first got interested in Japanese wrestling when I would read the like old After mags, and I'd see like the rankings of top 10, and then they'd have like top 10 for Japan. Who are these names? And then you'd see like names like the Road Warriors and the Steiners would all go over there, and they'd be in the rankings there. And then, of course, then when the Great Muda showed up in NWA, in Jim Cracker Promotions, I was like, who's this guy? Oh, my God. And then followed him back to Japan. And then of course, like when I first saw Jushin Thunder Liger, I was like, oh, my God, who's this guy? When he feuded with Brian Pillman in WCW. And it's like, I got to find more of this stuff. And then I think around in the early 90s, I started tape trading and buying tapes, and then I was interested in like getting some ECW stuff at the time, and then I saw the same dealer was like selling Japanese stuff. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll buy some of this stuff. And I just would search names for names I recognized, like Liger and Muda, so basically New Japan Pro Wrestling. And then later on from there, I would watch All Japan Pro Wrestling. Mm-hmm. And then from there, like later on, Toryumon, and then like Michinoku Pro and stuff like that.
I was very similar because I would get all those After mags as well, and you'd read about the Shinya Hashimoto's and the Kenta Kobashi's, and kind of you were familiar with these names. And it wasn't until I think at O'Grady's when, for me, my favorite part was that after Raw, usually it would be you that would bring down a tape of some classic Japanese matches, and we'd stick around for like an hour, hour and a half after Raw just watching these Japanese matches. And that was kind of my first kind of exposure. And then I started ordering tapes, and I think one of the first ones I got was this J-Cup event. And how about yourself, Wei? Because you've always been very closely tied
to it. Well, I've never tape traded, per se. I've never physically sent a VHS tape in the mail. I didn't even know, you know, it was really a common thing. But I kind of got into it, you know, after listening to The Law, after listening to Dave Meltzer's shows, and hearing everybody talk about the critical acclaim behind this weird professional wrestling from all the way on the other side of the world. And I thought, really, does this stuff really exist over there as well? And I came to find it through news groups and this thing called Hotline or Hot something. It was like this this program for Mac, and it was sort of before Napster, before any type of files.
You were pirating stuff before it was in vogue.
Exactly. So I went on like wrestling news groups, and I would just like suddenly download all these things that I had heard so much about, and I was really, really drawn to it because it was so different. And just from a personal perspective, it was really cool to see people that, for once, looked like me, had the same, type of complexion as me.
Asians can wrestle too.
Doing such amazing things, not simply portray a
stereotype. Not
exactly.
The flute music and the throwing of the powder, as we seem to see every week when we review a classic show. Well, let's get into it, because this is quite the show here to review, the Super J-Cup 94. Now, the premise of this, WH, if maybe you can set this up for, this was essentially Jushin Liger was booking the New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division at this time, and from what you can recall, I mean, what kind of led to this giant kind of amalgamation of all these junior heavyweights here for this big tournament?
Well, I think one of the things that happened with Jushin Liger was that he became such a star in New Japan. He kind of not revitalized, but he kind of took junior heavyweight wrestling to another level. Like in the 80s, it was Tiger Mask, original Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama, and Dynamite Kid who did a new style, and everyone's like, oh my god, what is this? But they didn't take it to a box office level. You know what I mean? That was an attraction that was on an undercard on New Japan shows and All Japan shows, like junior heavyweight wrestling. Jushin Liger, I think, took it to another level. Like, he took it to where it's like, I'm going to make it a viable box office draw where it's going to make money for the company in of itself. So they decided to, he got together. And like, one of the things about Jushin Liger you should know about, like, he's influential. He's like networking all the time, I think. That's the impression I get. It's like, so he reached out to all these different companies. Before, like, now in Japan, like, different interpromotional stuff is common. Yes. Common ground. It's like, it's so common.
Yeah.
Back then in the 90s, it was not. So he went to like FMW, Michinoku Pro. He went to like other indie groups and said, let's do a tournament together. And we'll hold it at Sumo Hall. And we'll go against, you know, at the time, at the same night, it's interesting. At the same night, they were running against another big show, which was the Champions Carnival Final.
I was not aware of this at all until you just mentioned this to me.
And for those who don't know, Champions Carnival is like the oldest professional wrestling, one of the oldest professional wrestling tournaments in the history of the business, and is run by New Japan's rival at the time, All Japan Pro Wrestling. Huh. So at the finals, I think it was like Dr. Dusty Williams versus Toshiaki Kawada, which like sold out Budokan Hall. And it was like a big chance to like just run an all junior heavyweight wrestling tournament at Sumo Hall. But if you watch the show, you can see like that it's capacity crowd. It's like full. So they did. So they proved that junior heavyweights can draw money. So.
Wow, amazing.
Well, the show started off with an opening video with all these just terms thrown out for the various performers. We had just random words like flying, powerful, passion. Then Black Tiger, Eddie Guerrero, came on, and he was described as radical, which would have more meaning later in years. Gorgeous, energetic, wildest, sophisticated, brilliant, dynamic, aggressive, challenger, and the last one was simply for pride.
You know, I get the sense that
I was already pumped after this video for the next 3 hours.
I get the sense that when Japanese people use English, it's more about the way it looks probably
the
actual
meaning. It's pretty accurate.
So they brought out all the competitors here.
Gorgeous wrestlers.
They brought out all the competitors. 14-man, one-night tournament. They brought out Masayoshi Motegi. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Masayoshi Motegi, yeah. He wrestled for the SPWF.
The Social
Progressive Wrestling Federation, which I really didn't know about them until like recently. I was like, that's the greatest professional wrestling company.
This was the one guy. I haven't watched the show in years, but it did not. I had question marks about this performer because I knew so little about him other than...
He didn't really go on to anything like beyond doing like
you look at this really
Japan.
And he was the one that kind of you didn't hear too much other than he was attached to this event. Then they brought out, of course, Hayabusa, Ricky Fuji, Gato, Super Delphin, Taka Michinoku, Great Sasuke, who you have to watch this video, I think, to truly acknowledge the reaction this guy was. This was the most loved babyface in this entire arena.
This show made him
It was. Yeah, like, this was the great Sasuke show, and we'll get into that. Negrokassis, Dean Malenko, Black Tiger, Wild Pegasus, Chris Benoit, Shinjiro Otani, El Samurai, and then coming out finally was Jushin Thunder Liger, who put this all together. And all the New Japan guys got very, very strong reactions. Sasuke as well, representing Michinoku Pro. But here you had FMW represented, War, Wrestle and Romance.
Wrestle and Romance, another great promotion name.
And, of course, a New Japan Pro Wrestling, and yes, the sole representative of the Social Progressive Wrestling Federation. And then they bring out Tatsumi Fujinami for the opening ceremony, and he brings in the WWF Junior Heavyweight Championship belt.
No, 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 the WWWF.
Sorry, the WWWF.
Was that what they were fighting for?
When New Japan and the WWF, like Vince McMahon's seniors promotion, used to work together, so they said, okay, we're going to have a junior heavyweight title, but we don't care about it in America. So New Japan, you can have it, you can use our initials, and that's your junior heavyweight title.
I don't get that, though. Why would they use their initials? Why wouldn't?
It's because there was before a time where they didn't have their own titles. Like New Japan ran, like, would use, I think the NWF was their main heavyweight title, which was their main belt. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what they used for tag titles, but their junior heavyweight title was the WWF title, and then junior heavyweight title. And then later on, they said, we got to have our own belt. So then they created the International Wrestling Grand Prix belts, the IWGP titles. And so they just phased out all these other belts. But I guess Vince McMahon Jr. didn't want the junior heavyweight belt back. And so he's like, you keep it, guys.
we'll go take that guy Taka at some point. So anyway, the title is brought out by Fujinami, and then we get right into the action, everybody. We kick things off with Gato and Dean Malenko. Now, for North American fans, probably your only exposure to Gato would have been when he came over for those series of matches with ECW, teaming up with Jado to take on Lance Storm and Just Incredible, and that's pretty much the only time you would have seen him over here in North America. These two have been linked throughout their entire careers, Gato and Jado.
Yeah, did they not have a short stint in WCW as well in some pay per view?
I'm not sure, but if you look at Ghetto now, and then you see him Ghetto now, and then you see him like at this show, 1994,
17 years ago. Yeah,
he's like this chubby guy with a mohawk mullet, and then
wearing this horrible red belly shirt. Yeah,
now he's totally ripped. He's like an IcoPro now or something like that.
IcoPro.
He's like Carrot Top.
Yeah, but now he's like shaved head and he's like completely ripped, and like you would never think that this chubby kid in red pajamas becomes like this ripped guy who's like a supreme worker. And do you know that Ghetto and Jado are also the bookers of New Japan now?
Yes, I am aware of that. But here's Gato, who has definitely aged well over in New Japan.
Yes, he has. Mm-hmm.
Post, I guess, no wellness intact there. Early on, we see Gato retreat to the floor following a series of drop kicks. Dean Malenko, if we want to talk about aging, this guy probably looks identical to what he looked like in 1994. I think he was probably looking like this at 15.
I think he was born like 40 years old. Maybe.
He has the Earl Hebner syndrome. Malenko early on works on the left leg of Gato, who then attempts an armbar, but Malenko blocks it. Malenko then comes back, hits a big vertical suplex for a two count. The crowd was applauding early on here. And then Gato applied an STF, a different kind of version of this, but Malenko was able to reach the ropes. Then Gato has a tombstone reversal. He hits it, then misses a top rope headbutt, eats a lariat from Malenko for a near fall. And that, to me, was the best reaction of the match thus far.
Before you go on, I was just going to say, when I first saw this show and I first started watching Japanese wrestling, whenever guys would do tombstones, I would always be amazed because
there was no reaction to them.
Well, because a tombstone in Japan is simply a setup move for a guy going up to the top rope. A tombstone is just the equivalent of maybe a vertical suplex here. So, being an American wrestling fan conditioned to The Undertaker, it was always quite the shock to see these guys just pull out tombstone pile drivers and basically treat it as almost nothing.
Yeah, and we saw them all throughout the show. And the finish came when Malenko ends up running into a power slam by Gato, who gets the win. It looked like Malenko was going to kick out right at the finish. I don't know if there was a miscommunication there, but that was the kickoff, and Gato goes over Dean Malenko.
He was doing the Scott Hall finish.
Yeah, can't wait to kick out of that finish, bro.
That's right. Oh, he beat me, but he didn't really beat me.
Can you comment a little? Is there a difference in the concept of a match from Japan versus North America?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, like, you know, when I started watching Japanese wrestling, like, I was like you. I was like, why are they, like, kicking out of these moves and stuff like that? But then as you watch it, you realize it's not like American wrestling, where American wrestling builds up to the finish,
mm-hmm.
With one finisher, like a finishing maneuver from signature move from someone. It's people have multiple finishers in Japan, mm-hmm. whether it be a submission or, like, a high-impact move or something like that. And you could also just win with, like, simple thing like a brainbuster, yeah. or not a simple thing like that, but, you know, like a brainbuster or, like, a figure four leg, like, or inside cradle or something like that.
It's much more realistic because throughout this show, you could see every near fall get a huge, huge reaction. And I guess that's attributed to the audience seeing these minor moves win matches in the past for all these guys, so everything is believable.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole psychology of finish can happen mm-hmm. anytime mm-hmm. with any move, as long as you they've built it up in terms of, like, they work over a body part or, like, where you're at your opponent with, like, tons of other moves, but then it can come out with, like, anything, like a power slam. Mm-hmm. Like in this move.
I like that about the booking, and I also liked how this wasn't a show where they simply went out and tried to burn out the audience by having the opening round matches go 20 minutes and you're mm-hmm. kicking out of everything. I thought the opening matches, they built really well. They got finishes over that would play into the stories in later matches, mm-hmm. and I thought the first round was booked very strongly.
Now, in terms of story, are there heels and baby faces in a lot of these matches?
Or in this tournament? No, not really. Like, some people were kind of acting kind of heelish, like Ghetto later on acts a bit mm-hmm. heelish in his match with Benoit, but no, there was no storylines in this. It's just mm-hmm. like who's going to be the number one junior heavyweight in this tournament.
Next up, we had Super Delphin taking on Shinjiro Otani, and Otani immediately goes after the left leg and then works it into a heel hook. Delphin reaches the ropes. Delphin then comes back with a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker. He tries again, but Otani counters into a spin kick and then a follow-up drop kick that sends Delphin to the floor. Crowd very much here behind Otani.
What can you tell us about Super Delphin?
Delphin, he was part of. The Michinoku Pro, mm-hmm. and then
he went to Osaka Pro after.
Well, he was the promoter of Osaka Pro, because he had a big falling out with Great Sasuke, and then he took like half the roster came with him to form Osaka Pro, so pretty much decimated Michinoku Pro, and then he left Osaka Pro apparently, and then formed Okinawa Pro. I don't know what's going on, but that's like even a smaller indie than what Osaka Pro was, because Osaka Pro was
that's
okay.
Tiny.
It's pretty tiny. It's like really small. People obviously can't see what I'm doing, but like it's like
you're making a gesture for something.
But he was okay worker. You know, like he was like probably number two babyface with behind Sasuke, especially when mm-hmm. they at the height of Michinoku's mm-hmm. pro popularity, they Great Sasuke had his like his regular army, the Michinoku Pro army, and then they would always fight the Kaientai Deluxe, which is like Dick Togo, Takamichi
Noku. Which is nothing like Kaientai you saw in the WWE.
No.
This was amazing Kaientai.
They weren't chopping anyone's penises
They were
off.
Incredible.
No. But, well, not on camera.
No.
But my question is, how did this guy, in what... I feel like only in Japan can you come up with the character of a half-dolphin man and wear a mask with a dolphin nose and be number two babyface in a company.
Yep.
In a glitter outfit, no less.
He was over. He was tremendously over.
How's that any
period.
Different from like a man wearing a clown suit?
A what suit?
A clown suit.
Clowns have, I can at least, I don't know.
Dolphins are popular
they're
in
not
Pacific
intimidating.
Region. Dolphins are popular in the Pacific region. You gotta keep all in mind. It's a cultural thing.
The dolphins are very valued over their way. Come on. We see a springboard dropkick to Delphin in the ring for a two count. If you've never seen a Otani springboard dropkick to the back of the head, this is that was like his staple maneuver.
Otani is just like, his style is just super vicious, you know? He looks like a businessman.
I love just the plain black tights and just went to the ring and worked. That was
But he wrestles like a monster. Like, yeah. He's just relentless. Yeah.
Consider that he debuted in 1992, so this is 2 years in.
Wow, 92 he debuted.
He debuted in 92, and so like this is 94, so he's only 2 years in the business. And he's
That's incredible.
This good. And he just became like, you know, I'd say between 95... and 99 before he mistakenly became a heavyweight, like that he was like a top five worker in the world.
Yeah,
because of the time period I'm talking about and like the people that were back in their primes at this point too.
We then see Delphin reaches the ropes, but Otani regains his position with a leg lock, pulls him into the middle, but once again, Delphin reaches the ropes. Delphin gets a hope spot here with a tornado DDT and crosses the arms of Otani and pins him here for the win. Was this like his finish at the time did this?
Yeah, the Delphin clutch.
The Delphin clutch.
Okay, because this was called. Treated as he might as well have hit him with a pedigree here, and I totally didn't understand this.
Yeah, the famous Delphin clutch.
The Delphin clutch.
What is the deal with this? This guy signals for his finish. And I'm waiting for this huge, spectacular move, and all he does is wrap the guy's legs for a pin. His finish is a pin.
I bet Otani was kind of grateful. I was like, oh, I don't have to take, like, a burning hammer.
Yeah, it's like, man, go to town here.
Tied up.
But it seemed to be over, this Delphin clutch.
Delphin cuts a promo backstage. I don't assume anyone translated it,
no.
So we'll assume he was very happy about moving on to the second round.
Dedicated to all the dolphins in the sea.
Yes. Yeah. Next up, Taka Michinoku taking on Black Tiger, a.k.a. Eddie Guerrero under the hood. Taka Michinoku at this time, also very, very... when would he have debuted here?
Yeah,
like
maybe,
he would have only been a few years in. Like he was kind of Sasuke's student, basically.
Maybe same time period, like maybe around 92, 93.
Yeah, so again, very, very new to the industry at this time. Tiger early on hits a somersault planche over the top rope. Then hits a powerbomb for a near fall. This is a minute in, and this was one of Eddie Guerrero's I'm going to murder you powerbomb.
Yes.
Holy crap.
You know, I seem to notice a trend in some of these matches, how they would start off with all their high spots, everything, just toss it out right at the beginning and then slow down the match. Is that something that's very common?
Well, I think with Eddie Guerrero as Black Tiger, he was like portrayed like as a heel, because like Black Tiger gimmick is the antithesis of Tiger Mask. Mm. So he's kind of a heelish, so he's going to just like, okay, I'm going to take this young kid who looks like he's 10 years older at this point, and then I'm just going to kill him with like power bombs and what have you. And like, I remember that power bomb. I'm like, that's like almost as vicious as the power bomb I saw Chris Benoit give him like on a WCW show. Once.
Yeah,
he was, like,
I mean, those boom. Two exchanged just some brutal power bombs. And getting back to this match, I mean, New Japan, especially at this time and on this show, they did such a good job of just Taka lasting here with Black Tiger. Mm-hmm. It was almost like a push for the guy, and the fact that he hung here with Black Tiger and came up short. And you look to today, if you're someone that's just following the like North American national scene right now, where wins and losses are so trivialized that it's so hard to even kind of understand that whole concept of just a guy hanging in there with a veteran like an Eddie Guerrero, and how that came across to the live crowd and those watching. But some other spots here, Black Tiger here with a sharpshooter in the middle of the ring. Then we saw Taka come off with a moonsault off the top rope. He misses Tiger and then takes a head scissors that sends Black Tiger to the floor. Does a moonsault off the top. The audience is into all the high flying here from Taka Michinoku. And I looked this up. Taka was 21 years old at the time of this match. So barely into things here. Taka then hit a springboard cross body to the floor. They go back into the ring. They're exchanging near falls. Tiger hits a body press into a power bomb for a two count, and then Tiger hits the frog splash for a two count, then a release power bomb by Taka for a two count, and then we go into the finish here where Tiger hits a brain buster for a two count, and then hits the tornado DDT and gets the win. And as we mentioned, just Taka Michinoku taking all of this offense, kicking out of a few of Tiger's like big moves. This was a big positive to me for Taka Michinoku here, trying to establish here as someone. A brand new junior heavyweight.
He played a fantastic underdog here, and like you mentioned, he was elevated at the end of this match, despite losing.
And then he'd realize all of that potential just a couple years later in the World Wrestling Federation.
That's right, being Bradshaw's driving buddy.
Next up, we have El Samurai taking on Masayoshi Motegi, and early on, we see a drop kick to the floor and then a tope suicida by Motegi. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Motegi, yeah, it's okay. You're white, it's okay.
Okay, I'm giving a pass on this. As Wei just looks at me disgustingly.
I'm shaking my head.
I just tear apart these names. They go to rest spots just a few minutes into this, and then after a big start here with the tope suicida. Samurai applies a Boston Crab, but Motegi powers out. Then we see Samurai with a tombstone for a two count. He then suplexes him onto his front. Samurai then with a back body drop to the floor, and then he delivers a tope suicida. We see a top rope drop kick delivered to Motegi, where he's just consistently selling. WH, I know you spotted this because the guy who was in Motegi's corner sporting some limited edition Zubaz pants.
I was going to say, like, they should call this the ZPWF because, like, Zubaz Pants Wrestling Federation. Because he came out in the opening ceremony wearing Zubaz, and all the seconds wearing Zubaz, I'm like, my God, they should just rename the federation to the Zubaz.
Quickly, for those not familiar with Zubaz pants, they were this, for whatever reason, this popular brand of pants at the time where, how would you even describe them? There was like these various colors where it looked like...
No, they were wearing like tiger prints or something like that.
Yeah.
But they're baggy pants.
And the Road Warriors had...
interest in them.
Yeah, they had interest in the company, which was at one point valued extremely high. They never sold when it was at this big peak and
only
ended
Japan.
Up
only with wrestlers, because you watch like wrestling in the 90s, like you'll see a lot of people, a lot of wrestlers wearing Zubaz pants
and the
fanny packs,
which, and the fanny packs have lasted throughout the test of wrestlers past. Anyway, we see a top rope drop kick delivered to Motegi, who then comes back. He delivers a surfboard. They kind of screw up a tilt-a-whirl in here as well. And the finish comes after a bridging German by Samurai for a two count, and then a power bomb into a pin by Samurai, and El Samurai is advancing here.
Did you notice that Motegi uses, like, the Rolling Germans in this match?
Yes, mm-hmm. I did. And that was... I had never seen the Rolling German spot before Benoit at this point, but here it was in this match.
He probably watched the tape later and said, I'm stealing that.
There you go. Any thoughts on this match, Mr. Ting?
I just thought it was good, you know. Nothing really stood out amongst anything else on the show.
We weren't at the Sasuke Classics yet. That's
where we'll
get into things.
What I did notice about those Rolling Germans, though, was the first time I really pinpointed and noticed the announcers going nuts. And I guess... To be a Japanese announcer for wrestling or MMA, you have to have almost two voices in your body.
You have to
have the regular voice, and then when the big spots come, you have to like almost just hit that switch and go into a completely different person.
I think it's genuine. I actually think...
Like, I love it.
I think so, too.
I think it's genuine. It's not like Tony Inoki is like yelling these guys' ears, hey, now scream, or anything like that. It's like genuine. They're actually, I think, fans of the product, and then when they see like spectacular moves, they just react like the fans do, and they just like go nuts.
And it's what JR does as well, too, right? Anytime, it just... It's a perfect accompaniment to what's going on inside the ring, and these announcers match what's going on perfectly.
Yeah, David Lagan has actually chatted about that on his podcast when he was producing Mike Hogwood, who was not a big wrestling guy, but Lagana would produce him in a way where he would say, okay, we need a level 3 here, and they'd establish what a level 4 is of how much he needs to really sell a finish or sell a big angle, and he'd kind of know kind of how to have things come across on TV. And
do you think a Josh Matthews or a Scott Stanford is aware of this leveling system?
Of Josh Matthews? Well, I don't think they're allowed to go past a 2.
I think I get the impression that like someone like Josh Matthews is actually a fan and would probably be more genuine if he didn't have like the Boston.
If you listen to him when he was doing like Florida Championship Wrestling and even when they first brought him onto ECW, I mean, I see a lot of upside in Josh Matthews. I think he just kind of gets painted with that brush of, you know, stereotypical new guy in the WWE on calling matches.
It's because he looks kind of like you.
Yeah. It's more of the
AJ from
AJ from Tough Enough is what I've been getting lately.
Have you
caught any Tough Enough lately?
No.
Because I know you're not following a lot of WWE these days, but Tough Enough is worth it just for the final 20 minutes with Austin cutting promos.
Tune in for the last 20 minutes.
I'll check these out then.
It's a lot of fun. All right, up next we have Ricky Fuji taking on Negro Casas. And Ricky Fuji, his gimmick was like he was a Canadian, but he was like your stereotypical Canadian if you've never been to Canada.
Calgary.
Yes, he's from Calgary.
That was his gimmick.
Yeah.
He actually trained in the dungeon, though.
He did train in the dungeon.
And then in FMW, the reason why he's wearing that motorcycle jacket with Canada on the back, because he's the leader of Team Canada.
Was it not that Ricky Fuji was a giant Chris Jericho fan, or was it the other way around?
I think Ricky Fuji is a big Rick Morton fan.
Yeah.
That's where he gets his name, I think. I'm pretty sure. I will put money on it that he was a big Rock and Roll Express fan, and particularly Ricky Morton. That's why he has that long hair and blonde. I think he's a contemporary of Chris Jericho.
Because I'm pretty sure Jericho talks about it in his book of something involving Ricky Fuji, but I can't remember the specifics
Jericho
about it.
Jericho was just starting out at this point, yeah. Was he not?
He started in 1990.
And then he would show up in the next J-Cup in 95.
Yeah, that's right, where he had his kind of breakthrough.
So he was the leader of Team Canada, and who else was on this
team? Oh, God, Mike Awesome as the Gladiator.
Awesome from Tampa.
Rick Bogner.
Rick Bogner, not from Canada.
Isn't he Canadian?
Rick Bogner.
I think he's Canadian.
He might have been Canadian. That was the fake Razor Ramon.
Okay.
And Dr. Luther, who I know is Canadian.
Yeah, he was definitely Canadian.
Because Gladstone talks about him all the time. Yeah. And then one more person who I forget, but definitely probably not Canadian.
All right.
That's
awesome. Well,
Team Canada before WCW had the idea.
So Ricky Fuji here, who, I don't know, the guy didn't blow me away as a worker. This guy was much more a character here. But comes out, he has like this, you know, music you would hear in a saloon in Calgary. He pulls down his shirt when he comes out for the entrance to reveal no chest hair, but just pulls it down just to reveal his chest is beneath. He's got the big, like, aviator shades. This guy was just awesome. Cassius, early on here, goes for an STF. Then he goes to the top rope and jumps to the floor. He falls short of Fuji, and the spot was totally kind of a missed here. He kind of just like undershot Fuji on the floor. Then there was an awkward spot where Fuji comes off the top as Cassius is getting to his feet, and they just crash like in mid-move here. We saw a Mahistral cradle there by Cassius for a one count, and the crowd reacted to it as he kicked out at one. Then a senton by Cassius for a two count off the second rope. Then he went for another senton off the second but misses. And then Fuji hits the double underhook suplex, which mid-90s WWF fans would identify as the Pearl River Plunge that Ahmed Johnson
Tiger Driver.
Murdered millions of guys with. Yes.
The Tiger Driver.
And gets the win here with this finish.
I just want to say something about the music. Like, that's a lot of actually like stuff that they pipe in post-production, because like a lot of the music, that entrance music they use at the show was like famous songs that they didn't have rights for.
Oh, and so
they have to use
to
generic
sell the
music.
Tape and stuff. They just put generic music.
They just put generic music over it. Yeah.
All right.
Nice little tidbit.
I had no clue. This was ECW didn't go to those lengths. It was like, fuck it, just put the Metallica on there. And then next we go to the biggest match of the first round. We have Hayabusa taking on Jushin Thunder Liger.
Now, was this Hayabusa's first appearance in Japan under the mask?
No. I mean, he'd been working for FMW for a long time.
But from reading what I read, it said that he adopted the gimmick while in Mexico just before the J-Cup, and he was called in to work this.
Maybe. I never followed like FMW and those guys too much.
Nonetheless, but he was very new at the time.
I think people knew who he was under the mask because he'd been wrestling under his real name for a long time in FMW, so they probably recognized who he was, but just the FMW brand was pretty strong at this point, so like he was representing FMW. It was like, okay.
What would you compare the level of popularity FMW was to something that we could relate to in North America?
ECW.
Yeah.
Basically, okay. Which is ironic because...
Three.
Yeah, yeah. Which is ironic because ECW basically is an American version of FMW.
Mm. Okay, cool.
Without the dynamite up the ass matches that they would have with Hayabusa and Mr. Gonosuke at one point.
Listen, have you ever seen those matches?
I have seen those matches.
They're awesome.
Those matches.
No one sells like a firecracker up his ass like Hayabusa.
Those matches always got to pop, literally. Early on, this was what I thought that was a good joke.
I liked it.
Hayabusa jumps at him to start the match with a tope con hilo to the floor. This was a match where, as you pointed out, they started off really hot right out of the get go. We see a top rope drop kick to the head of Liger in the ring, and then Hayabusa works on the right leg of Liger. Liger came back with a leg submission and then a power bomb for a two count. Liger then takes a Irish whip to the corner and a running heel kick to the face of Hayabusa. And then we go over. Hayabusa comes back and delivers a Liger kick and then a drop kick, spinning heel kick. And both were just exchanging lots of kicks here. Then there was a moonsault off the top rope into mid-ring. I thought this was a tremendous distance that Hayabusa landed here, getting a two count onto Liger. And Hayabusa ended up taking I'm lost here on my notes. It was a brain buster, and my notes are all fucked up here. How was the finish here? Liger?
It was just a fisherman buster.
Fisherman buster, yeah.
That was for the win, yeah. Yes. At one point, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but Hayabusa attempts a shooting star press and misses. And of course, that was a move invented by Liger. So, but the miss was a little bit scary because he lands almost face first.
Like on his
Yeah. Kind of, I mean, Hayabusa, like everybody knows what happened. And I was a huge, huge fan of what he was able to do, but I have to say I didn't think he was the most graceful wrestler. Like, and this is not a knock at all, but like he reminds me of somebody like Jeff Hardy, whose offense is not always very crisp, but his high flying always looks great.
Yeah, he's not as crisp as
like a Sasuke
or Sasuke.
Yeah,
but he's a tremendous athlete.
Yes,
and
yes.
I mean, one of the reasons he got so popular in Japanese wrestling was because of his charisma. He's just like so charismatic, and
great look too.
And great look, great gimmick, and he had great matches with people in FMW. So I mean, yeah, it's scary to watch this match just because like you know what happens to him later on with the with the screwed up lion salt where he lands on his head and stuff.
Yeah, so, that happened. For those not familiar, Hayabusa, he was doing a lion salt in 2001. That would be the move you'd best understand it. It's identified as landing on his head and was paralyzed after that, never wrestled again. So that was that was 10 years ago that occurred.
Yeah.
So
this is I'm very glad, just as a fan, that this match actually took place and they booked this match, because we'll never get to see it again.
So they have a promo backstage with Hayabusa, and then they recap all of the first round matches because Great Sasuke and Wild Pegasus had buys into the second round. And
do you know why?
No. Sasuke probably just paid someone off.
Well, and when you figured what Sasuke had laid out for the night, I would be fine with three matches. Ask this guy for a fourth out of him.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this was like one of the greatest one-night performances you'll ever see from a guy.
I think with Benoit, he just... probably because of his own standing in New Japan, he just got I would imagine they ran an angle where
was he a champ or something?
He'd been a multiple IWGP junior heavyweight champion at the time, so I imagine they ran an angle in some show where they said, oh, I'm gonna get the buy, and then Sasuke probably like won something in Michinoku Pro, and he's like, oh, I'm gonna get a buy into the quarterfinals.
And we start off the quarterfinals with Gato and Super Delphin. These would be two underdogs, I think, in this tournament to go far. Gato starts working on the leg of Delphin, and then they exchange a series of chops. And they were definitely working like a lucha style early on here. Gato hits a super kick and then a lariat for a two count. There's a near fall for Delphin where he comes back with a victory roll, and then another when he has a crucifix roll up, and then a bridging German for a two count. Delphin is hitting Gato with everything, and the story was that nothing here can beat Gato. And then Delphin hits the tornado DDT off the top, goes for a pin, and then Gato just rolls him up with a small package and gets the win. And Gato just afterwards just like points to his head.
Well, Delphin was attempting the Delphin clutch, and Gato countered it, basically.
And the momentum just took Delphin right out of this, and he just could not possibly kick out.
Yes.
His mind was committed to the
Delphin clutch. You shouldn't have gone for that shitty Delphin clutch.
So.
Oh, shitty in your eyes, but it beat many a man.
Do you want to try it right now on me?
No.
It could paralyze you. Next up, we've got Black Tiger and Wild Pegasus. Basically here, Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit. Would this have been one of the first times they would have faced off, or would they
have
probably quite a lot in New Japan
quite
at that
a lot
point? Because at what point was Black Tiger going over there? Like, when did that gimmick begin?
That gimmick...
Because he was working AAA at the same point at 94.
He was the second person to wear the Black Tiger gimmick. The first was Mark Rollerball Rocco when he feuded with Satoru Sayama, the original Tiger Mask. So... Eddie came in, I think he did some shows. His first tour may have been just as himself. Mm-hmm. And they said, we need something for you. Oh, we'll give you Black Tiger. And then he was probably the best Black Tiger to do that. I mean, then later on was like, third one was Silver King, was third Black Tiger. Mm-hmm. And then Rocky Romero was the fourth Black Tiger. But I think Eddie, hands down, was the best Black Tiger I had ever seen. I've seen like original Black Tiger matches as well, so...
Both exchanged leg holds to begin and transition back and forth. We see a tope by Guerrero into the ring onto Benoit. Benoit then hit a reverse vertical suplex to drive Tiger onto his stomach.
Sorry, just a request. Can you call him Pegasus for me?
Sure.
Call him Pegasus. Because I'm Wild again, Texas. what society would accept Pegasus? Your name is going to be Pegasus Kid.
Wild Pegasus.
Well, he was Pegasus Kid when he had when he had the mask, and then he lost the mask, and then he became, well, now he's Wild Pegasus. Because that no mask makes him more wild.
He's gone wild.
Yes.
His hair is unkept. There was a great looking Bridging German here by Benoit for a two count, and Pegasus. Then Benoit delivered this brutal power bomb. Sorry. Pegasus delivered this brutal power bomb. This was a. These two, I don't know what it was with power bombs, but watching this today, it was like, fuck.
They probably power bomb each other back at the hotel too. Hey, I'm bored. Can I power bomb you? Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
It was all Benoit until he pressed Tiger up in. See, all my notes here are Guerrero and Benoit.
All right,
completely
throwing
a wrench here. Everyone knows who we're talking about. Black Tiger comes back here with a Hurricane Rana, and then it's a Black Tiger with a Bridging German for a two count. And then Black Tiger applied the camel clutch, which his father kind of introduced, which if Muhammad Hassan had ever seen this tape, did you ever hear that story?
No.
It was backstage at a SmackDown show, and Eddie Guerrero used the camel clutch, and Hassan was using this as his finish, and this fucker, who was in the company for like a year, goes up to Eddie backstage, "Don't you ever use my finish out there." And this was like Eddie Guerrero is being told this. I believe Bradshaw and company tossed this guy right out of the locker room on the spot. And that was like the downfall of this guy.
Yeah. My dad invented that move.
Well, my dad invented that move, fucker. Yeah. And if you want me to pull out my driver's license so you know my fucking name. Unbelievable. These kids. Anyway, we see Guerrero with the hand of Benoit, jumps to the top rope, and he nearly slips, but pulls off a Hurricane Rana here off of the top rope, and then into a top rope Hurricane Rana for a two count. The crowd was very much into this towards the finish. Benoit makes a comeback, puts Guerrero on the top rope. He's pushed off by Black Tiger, who then jumps off into a Benoit arm drag in midair, and Benoit gets the win with an arm drag out of nowhere.
Yeah, I didn't really buy this.
I've never seen Benoit do this finish ever.
I don't. Well, I think was this a regular finish of Benoit's?
No. It's just one of those. I can beat you anytime with some move.
I always love when you win with different stuff, just to.
Yes. I think to me it was so abrupt because I was so not used to an arm drag finishing a guy. But
this was off the top though. If you can take the Dolphin Clutch as a finish.
Yes.
Everything's okay. Game. Now, I'm curious. Like, me and Wei started doing this show like a year and a half ago, and I remember the first time we reviewed a show where Benoit was on the show. It was fucked up for me to watch this, because I'd watched nothing since Benoit had died. Have you watched a lot of Benoit matches? Is it weird watching him do wrestling matches, or is it just kind of you can separate?
I can separate now. Like, when it first happened, I was like, I can't watch any of his matches. I can't really think about him because he was one of my favorite wrestlers for the longest time. But after hearing, like, interviews with, like, Chris Jericho where he says, I can separate the friend that I knew to the monster that did what he did. Because I do truly believe, like, it was the amount of brain damage he took that turned him into the monster that he became that murdered his family is different from the person I see on like footage, like the wrestler that was what I heard from everyone who knew him was a really nice guy. So like I can divorce like the two entities, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still kind of weird to me, but it was when the first time I watched it would have been like 2.5 years after everything happened, and it was just completely odd to be watching this guy in a wrestling match. Like, I just had a very hard time getting into it at all.
Yeah, that's weird. I mean, it is. While watching this, it did feel a little bit weird to me as well, because this was like sort of Benoit in a different light than what I'm usually used to, like seeing him in the WWE and everything. So it kind of put more emphasis on him as a person, you know, just starting out in his career and such. But I can go ahead and do it just because I feel like I can just look at him as this almost like a generic wrestler who's very good at what he does, but. You know, like, this is not the time to comment on him as a human being or what he's done. It's a show to talk about what the people on this show, on this wrestling show, have produced, and they all produced a fantastic thing. So we'll talk about that.
Next up, we've got the first match from great Sasuke taking on El Samurai. And Sasuke just gets this monstrous reaction here in Sumo Hall. He has Taka Michinoku in his corner. I mean, this guy was just, he was the person these people came to see. They loved this guy. It was incredible. For those unfamiliar, great Sasuke was known as Black Ninja in WCW versus NWO World Tour.
That's right.
On Nintendo 64. Right. A lot of this roster was on that video game.
Under different names. When I started watching Japanese wrestling, I'd be like, I played that guy just yesterday.
Hakushi, that's Shaolin. I think that's who it was.
Well, those games were based originally off of Japanese versions, right?
Yeah. So we start off the match. Sasuke goes for a leg lock as Samurai works for an arm bar and then back to their feet. Samurai stomps on the left knee of Sasuke and continues to work it over with elbows, and he's twisting the left knee. Samurai then gets him into a submission with his arm and legs tied.
The octopus stretch.
And the crowd is chanting Sasuke. I think this was the most they were into any match up until this point. I mean, it was incredible here. Sasuke comes back with a handspring elbow and then a handspring into a moonsault over the top to Samurai onto the floor.
I think that's the space flying tiger drop. It's one of those two. I forget which one, but
I like the second name better.
Space flying tiger drop?
Yeah.
It's tremendous.
It was got a huge reaction here from the crowd. Samurai then comes off the ropes and into a spinning heel kick by Sasuke. And then Samurai comes back with a lariat, a drop kick to the floor. And then we see a top rope headbutt by Samurai for a two count. Then Sasuke starts to make his comeback here. He reverses a Hurricane Rana by Samurai into a roll up for a two. Sasuke then counters an electric chair off the top into a sunset flip for a two. And the finish comes as Samurai goes for a Hurricane Rana with a roll up follow through. Sasuke counters and rolls up Samurai from the momentum to get the win. And I thought this was the best match on the card thus far on the show.
The last 6 minutes of this was spectacular. It was like one counter after another, and the crowd was into every single near fall.
I just thought Sasuke was just like the best babyface. I mean, this guy who was just overpowered at times, would make these comebacks that the crowd was so into. I thought he was just fantastic.
It was a high flyer as well that does spectacular looking things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So. Well, the thing about Sasuke, you have to remember, like, he's really well-rounded. Like,
yeah.
He's a great submission wrestler. He's a great mat wrestler. Mm-hmm. And does all this high flying, too. And his martial arts stuff looks really good, too. Like, his kicks and his punches and stuff like that all look really good. Because I think as I recall, he's pretty well-rounded, like, martial arts background and wrestling background, too.
And politically as well.
And politically too, yes.
That's true. You have a story of meeting Sasuke when you were in Japan.
Yes, if certain people...
Let's bring it up now.
Certain people, go to my Facebook profile right now, Wei Ting. You can see my photo with myself and the great Sasuke. And how I obtained this photo was I was on a trip through Tokyo, I think about 2 years ago or 3 years ago now, and I was just there with my brothers, and then we were taking the subway, the JR, and my brother was just like, we were waiting for a bus, and my brother's like, hey, come over, check this out, look at this freak, look at him. And there I looked, this guy was standing in the convenience store reading a magazine wearing a wrestling mask. And I'm like, at first I'm like, wow, what a weirdo. What the hell? Then I walk in closer, and I'm like, that is a great Sasuke mask. Yeah. And then I just keep thinking, isn't he some type of a politician or something? And there, I think within like a second, I like fully confirmed. I didn't even doubt that this was just some dude wearing a fake wrestling mask. Like, I knew within a second that this was the person. This was the great Sasuke. Like, he had the build. And here he was, just this man dressed in a, slacks and a collared shirt with a mask on his head. And so I just go up and I say hi, introduce myself and tell him I'm from Canada. And then immediately he's like, oh, okay, great, cool. And then, like, he poses for a picture, signs an autograph, gives me a little, card that he carries around with him.
So what's weirder, running into great Sasuke in a subway or seeing Jushin Thunder Liger at St. John's Hall in Mississauga, Ontario.
That was pretty weird as well. Yes, Jushin, did you, were you at that show, WH?
I was actually not at that show.
I know you went to a lot, and I remember, like, whenever they would bring in some of these talents, you'd be just like to me, how the fuck are we going to see Ultimo Dragon here in Mississauga?
Yeah.
It was just nuts.
Is that odd? Because, like, we regard these people as such, like, almost as, like, gods, you know, like, over in Japan. But here they come over, and they're wrestling for a crowd of, what, 100 people? 200?
My favorite reaction at a UWA show was when Joe McCausland, what was the character he
used? Joey Slick.
But he also wrestled under a mask. And I can't remember what his character was called, but at intermission, a guy comes up to Wei, says, hey, nice match. Assuming this Asian guy has to be a wrestler.
I didn't know that was Joey Slick.
The last person I would think who could work would be Joey Slick. No offense if he's listening. I just, yeah.
He probably is. We'll go to our next match, and it's Ricky Fuji and Jushin Thunder Liger. This would be a Styles clash. Fuji, I just noted here. I don't know why I didn't pick this up in the first match. Just his tights were just screaming 80s. It's great. I really enjoyed this character, Ricky Fuji. He was a lot of fun.
Tremendous.
He was actually in talks at one point with the WWF in the early 90s to come in, and for whatever reason, it just never panned out. But if
could you imagine?
Yes, I could have, totally.
Can he speak English?
He could have been... Instead of Al Snow, it could have been him and the New Rockers with Marty Jannetty.
Oh, there you go.
Can you imagine how awesome that would have been?
That was...
My mind boggles right now.
Did you ever hear the story about who came up with the New Rockers gimmick?
No.
We had Jannetty on, like, last summer, and he's like, yeah, Sean told Vince, suggested that for us. Be the New Rockers where we're a bunch of nerds. It's like, that was fucking Sean. Yeah, here, throw his buddy a bone.
Considering Shawn Michaels back in that period, it does not surprise me.
Probably not. Anyway, early on, there's a powerbomb delivered to Liger right on the floor, and Fuji ends up coming off the top rope, takes a clothesline from Liger. Then we see a foot stomp by Liger off the top to the floor onto Fuji. No matter how many times I watch that spot, I just always cringe.
How do you work? I guess it's only the point of contact is so quick, right?
No, I think it hurts.
Yeah.
I think it still hurts.
The margin for error to miss a guy's ribs is like, Christ.
So I don't know how low-key does it. Like, when he jumps
off
the top.
Yeah, low-key doesn't just, like, cautiously come off the top. Like, he's putting everything into that fucking stomp.
Yeah, he probably stole it from the show, probably.
Jesus. Anyway, we see a Fuji counters a superplex off the top and lands on top for a two count in midair. Then Fuji with a baseball slide. He then attempts a superplex again off the top rope. He's stopped, and Liger hits a Hurricane Rana off the top and then into a pin. And that was your finish there. Decent match. I mean,
didn't stand up.
Nothing blow away. About the best I think you're going to get out of Ricky Fuji here.
Yeah, I don't think Liger was like, I'm not going to get this guy. Like, I'll do the best I can with him, but I'm not going
to. I got a match with Sasuke coming up in an hour.
Save it for then.
Liger takes out both FMW guys. And I guess my question is, do you think, I can't ever see a concept like this working in North America.
No.
Because how are you going to, how is a FMW supposed to say, all right, okay, I'm going to give you two of my top light heavyweights and you can let them lose. You are allowed to go over both
of
them before
the final. Well, I think the thing with that is that FMW said, okay, it's going to be one of the biggest shows of the year. It's going to get a lot of press. So if we have two of our guys on there and they have good showings, at least one of them can get into the quarterfinals. I'm pretty sure they negotiated all of, like, who gets how far and stuff like that. And I think Ricky Fuji was a bit more established than Hayabusa at this time, so they said, okay, you can beat Hayabusa in the first round, but try to make him look good. And Liger has his reputation and said he'll put over anyone. Even if he wins, he's putting over the guy he works with and makes him look like a superstar. So I'm sure he's like, okay, I'll make this kid look good, and then Fuji will advance in the second round, and then I'll beat him there, and then that's FMW's like, awesome, great.
That does make sense.
It's more than we can ask for.
And it's against Jushin Liger, right?
It's against Jushin Liger. It's not like they lost to, like, you know, like some schmo. It's not like it's not like they're losing to, like, the Alex Riley of New Japan or something like at this point.
They follow Liger backstage, and I noted one of the crew members was wearing a WrestleMania 10 leather jacket. Which would have just happened like a month before this event. They hear from Ricky Fuji backstage.
Translate.
I wish there was like subtitles on this. Would have been great. And then we go to the third round. It's Wild Pegasus and Gato. And these two murdered each other with slaps early on here. It's a huge lariat by Benoit. Then he hits a guillotine leg drop. Gato had like the worst wrestling gear here. He was like, his arm was all tangled through it. It was like this belly top that it was just like looked like the most uncomfortable thing to work in here.
Well, I thought they looked like pajamas.
They looked like pajamas. I was like, who's this fat guy with the pajamas? But he's a good worker.
And like this awful, awful mullet, even by early 90s standards. This was
you know what the thing with the slap was? It looked like, because Benoit drops down, and then Gato stops himself in the ropes, and he's like, I don't know if that was planned or not, but you just got him. He just like smacked him in the face. How do you screw up my spot?
This fucker in his pajamas. Gato's putting the heat on Benoit in the opening couple of minutes. They go back to another chop exchange. Benoit goes to the floor, and Gato is on top with a twisting moonsault to the floor onto Benoit. Wild Pegasus. Gato then misses a top rope headbutt in the ring. Benoit tries to come back with an overhead suplex, but Gato lands on top for a pin attempt. Both are fighting for control, and it ends with Benoit hitting a powerbomb for a two count. Then he hits another powerbomb and then hits his top rope headbutt, and he gets the win here. Mm-hmm. So, Wild Pegasus advancing.
I found that the crowd was pretty solidly behind the underdog Gato here. Mm-hmm. You know, wrestling like somebody who should be losing, but putting up a great effort, much like that.
It's kind of the same story they told in the Gato match, where he pretty much outsmarted Delphin after mm-hmm. taking all of his offense, and he was booked as this underdog here, and going, he would go to the finals, the 95 J.
The 95 one, and I think he beat Benoit in the semis in that show, as I'm pretty sure.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've watched that 95 one. And then we go to Jushin Thunder Liger and the great Sasuke. I had to turn my tape off and just wait for like 10 minutes because I knew what I was going to watch was going to be fantastic. And very slow start here, a bit of chain wrestling, and then they're exchanging submission holds. Liger hits Way's favorite transition, the tombstone, and then goes into a
crossface chicken wing
submission, and then begins working over the left arm of Sasuke.
I love like Liger's moveset. When I played wrestling video games, I would always create Liger, and they would have like a template of Jushin Ligers, so you could get every move, and then he was the only guy where you could get the shooting star press as a regular move. Like, you didn't have to select it as a finisher, so you always had room for your finisher. So, there you go.
That's why you love Liger.
That's why, yes. Exactly.
You should have told him that when you met him.
Yeah.
You made my video game experiences so much more pleasurable.
You probably got a thrill out of that, actually.
Liger, like, played subtle heel during this match, and I enjoyed it a lot in this. Liger here, going for a Kimura, and then transitions into an armbar in 1994.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Sasuke was selling like he was dead here from the punishment, and then made a brief comeback with an Asahi moonsault to the floor, and he lands it on Liger and then just crashes into the guardrail here. Looked like he was dead after this.
And continues selling the arm that Liger was working on.
Then we go back. Sasuke is back on offense, hits a spinning heel kick, a pile driver in the ring, and then a powerbomb for a pin. Gets a two count. Crowd was very, very hot at this point. Then Sasuke hits another tombstone. He goes to the top rope. He misses a swanton, and Liger then cuts off Sasuke with a lariat. We see a sit-out powerbomb and then a roll-up by Liger for a two-count. Then there's a vertical suplex by Liger that sends Sasuke over the top rope into the floor. Sasuke takes a rolling kick back to the floor, and then he attempts a springboard when he comes back. He slips and falls here as he does this springboard, and he comes back with a Hurricane Rana and scores the pin for the win and the big pop. I know a lot of people will point to this like slip off the top rope, but to me, it kind of played into the whole story that this guy had been killed here for 15 minutes and struggled to come back and pin Liger.
The recovery was perfect because Liger's reaction to Sasuke tripping was just like pointing at him
and laughing. He's like,
it was great. It was like there was no
so
hesitation.
Smart.
There was no deer in the headlights moment that you got. Like when we saw Sin Cara and Primo on Monday, I mean, giant fuck up where Sin Cara just went right back into the exact same sequence. They just fucked up and it was just calling attention to it. This, it just seems seamless, and I don't think you have to look at something that maybe it was blowing, but you can't just improvise and make it work fine. I had no problem with this. So, very, very strong match. And that was two matches here from Great Sasuke that I think were in the four-star plus level.
And you mentioned, you know, Liger's willingness to book people ahead of himself. Even despite being the booker for this show, you have to consider this an upset almost to have this.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone figured Liger was going to win the whole thing. If not, at the very least, go to the finals. So they thought, okay, Great Sasuke went to the semis. That's great. But then when he beat him, it was like, oh, my God, okay, he's going to the finals. So I think that added to the crowd getting really behind Sasuke for the next match.
And I thought it added more to the dynamic of the finals, where you have your New Japan representative and then you have your Michinoku Pro representative. I just thought it made for a more interesting finals. And based right off the top of the show with Sasuke, I mean, that was the guy that should have been booked to go to the finals.
Absolutely.
And the thing about like Liger is, like, if you look at his career as a booker, he doesn't book for his ego. He books to make money, and he understands, like,
what?
Yeah,
what's this concept? What?
Booking for money. Like, he understands, like, I'm gonna book this guy to beat me, because then when we have a rematch and I beat him, I look stronger, and then it's gonna draw more money.
I don't understand any of this talk.
But even what you mentioned is in this context, it's a pretty interesting, because he is not only elevating the show, he is elevating a rival from another promotion.
Yeah.
But yet, and they, I guess...
Well,
the
they
end,
also had a working
sense.
Agreement with Michinoku Pro. Like, a lot of the Michinoku Pro guys would do, like, multi-man tags on New Japan shows. And then Sasuke would actually win, like, not only, like, the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title at some point, but he'd also become... I think he's the first J-Crown champion as well. And then that's all Liger booking that stuff, I think, because it meant, like, I have more people to work with and draw more attractions to draw money with.
What's also really interesting is that at this time period, I mean, New Japan was super hot at this point. I mean, usually when you see these co-promotions, it's, you know, we're in trouble financially right now and we have to work together. That really wasn't the case. There was no gun to New Japan's head to work with these other offices, create new talent. I mean, this was it was really foreign to wrestling at the time to see this kind of a cooperation, especially at that time period.
I also think it helps that it was junior heavyweights. I don't think you would necessarily get this with, like, New Japan heavyweights. Like, I don't think you would see Shinya Hashimoto or Kishimoto or Masahiro Chono doing as much for a guy from another heavyweight, another star from another company. That's not saying against them. It's just, like, the culture is like, okay, well, they're the junior heavyweights we can do it with because they're not our box office main attractions.
Yeah, fair enough. And I don't know how much time there was in an interval here, but pretty much your tape just goes right to the finals here.
There was supposed to be another match on the show, just an exhibition match between Ray and his Psychosis, wasn't
no,
there?
No, that was 95.
Which actually happened, which is an amazing match.
Yeah, it's an awesome match. So here we go. Great Sasuke and Wild Pegasus in the finals of the very first J-Cup. And Sasuke early on... Benoit pulls out a cravat to start off this, and Sasuke is able to flip out. Benoit goes to the floor. Sasuke teases a dive, but Benoit moves out of the way. Sasuke is then applying pressure to the back of Benoit, uses a bow and arrow here. Sasuke, just incredible his speed here. When you consider what this guy has already done earlier in the night, these two matches he had, like, you would never assume that if you were just watching this as a standalone match. Benoit leaps off the second rope and takes Sasuke off the apron to the floor with a forearm. Then we see a full Nelson suplex for a two by Benoit. There's a back and forth flurry between the two, ending with Benoit hitting a bridging German for a two count. Sasuke counters another full Nelson and tries to roll up Benoit, who falls on top of Sasuke for a two count. Later on, Sasuke misses a drop kick off the top as Benoit is recovering, goes to the apron and hits a vertical suplex as both go to the floor. Sasuke comes back with a missile drop kick off of the top turnbuckle to the floor onto Benoit. Missile drop kick to the floor.
Yes.
Fuck. And then crowd is applauding both as they get back into the ring to continue. We see a moonsault by Sasuke off of the top for a two count. And then once again, Sasuke climbs to the top. Benoit stops him, hits an overhead suplex, but Sasuke counters, lands on top of Benoit, and Sasuke gets the win. Huge, huge pop here, and a phenomenal finals match.
You mean Benoit won?
Sasuke climbs. Benoit hits over with the overhead suplex and gets the win here. So, a phenomenal tournament here, and this really was the great Sasuke show.
Absolutely. I mean, Benoit was great, but Sasuke really stole the show for me. To be able to put on two performances like this consecutively, it's mind-blowing.
Even the opener, his opening one with El Samurai. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a one-night performance at this level.
Yeah, I don't think before or since you've had like a performer like Sasuke who had three really grueling matches. Like the Samurai one, not so much, but I mean that's still like a high level match. And then like the one he had with Liger was definitely like could have main evented anywhere like in Japan, and it would have like people would have been like, oh my god, that's match of the night. And then he followed up with the match with Benoit that was. And just as good, if not better.
Like. And the finals, I mean, following this show, I mean, this was like easily 4 hours deep. These fans here had been at Sumo Hall probably a lot longer than that.
And they were going nuts for everything.
Yeah, it was incredible. Everyone came in to congratulate Benoit afterwards. Benoit and Sasuke shake hands. Fujinami presents Benoit with the WWF Junior Heavyweight title. His first championship from the promotion.
Well, it wasn't really he got the title. That wasn't like he was going to defend it or anything. Like,
no, just, it was just kind of like a trophy.
Yeah. But you know what was better?
The yellow jacket?
The yellow jacket that says
winner
on the back.
Oh, I would love this jacket. They then hand out trophies to various performers. They have the customary group picture with all of the combatants. And then they show them backstage, they take another picture, and Benoit does a promo saying this is the greatest honor of his career. And that was the Super J Cup, a fantastic, fantastic show, in my opinion.
And good job, John. This was a lot of, not much storyline and a lot of play-by-play, basically, that you just had to do for a full hour. So.
Well, other than fucking up the winner of the entire tournament, I think I did okay there. So, I mean, usually WH, we kind of have a system here where we give a ranking out of 10. I mean, what would you put this in terms of a ranking system?
I think a lot. 10, yeah.
Now, you've always debated that you feel this, because a lot of people have always debated. I mean, one of the best pay-per-views of all time, you'll throw out the WrestleMania 17 and When Worlds Collide. Those are the two that kind of are at everyone's kind of peak level. Where do you think this show ranks kind of in the annals of all-time shows you've seen? I mean, is it right at the top for you? I enjoyed this one more than 95, to be honest.
I don't know if it's at the top. I'd say top three for sure. Like, in terms of WrestleMania 17, like, I'd say maybe tie with that. Like,
yeah.
But when Worlds Collide, it wouldn't be. Worlds Collide would fall under because I like when Worlds Collide, but it's really overrated.
Yeah.
I think that what makes that show is like the crowd reaction, but that's another show altogether, I'm sure. But like in the top three for sure.
It really depends on what you look for as a wrestling fan. You know, everybody's tastes are different. So maybe some people prefer the spectacle and the grandeur of WrestleMania or a Lucha Libre style. So it's very tough to say.
Like the second Noah Tokyo Dome show with Kawada and Misawa and Kensuke Sasaki versus Kenta Kobashi is like an amazing show throughout, and I would rank that a bit higher.
The common link there between When Worlds Collide and this J Cup, I mean, they took place like 7 months apart. When Worlds Collide was November, you had Benoit on that show, as well as
Eddie
Guerrero, who had that huge tag title.
And Sasuke impersonator Octagon.
Yes, that's right. So we'll get into some quick feedback here, because we do have WH here, and we put a thread up asking people, you know, even if you haven't seen the J Cup, if you have some basic questions, if you're not familiar with Japanese wrestling, and we've got an expert here. So are you ready here for some rapid fire questions, WH? We're putting you up huge here.
Oh my god!
First off, from Jay Hunter. Okay, the first question we're going to skip because it's the... Can you give us an overview of Japanese wrestling since the 80s?
It's great.
It's great. The main differences in the mentality, we kind of discussed that. Did you ever get to watch a lot of All Japan Women?
No, what they call Joshi Pro Wrestling. I never got into it too much. I've seen some stuff like with Manami Toyota and Bull Nakano and people like that, but I never really got in depth into like Joshi Pro Wrestling myself.
Jay also wants to know, how healthy right now is the business for New Japan, Noah, All Japan, and what were kind of the peak years for some of these companies? I mean,
peak years, like I mean, would be from like the 80s, and then the 90s were like huge years, especially for New Japan, because they ran the angles with UWFI, which sold out, which were, I think, their first Tokyo Dome sold out.
Yeah, Muto and Vader?
Not Vader, it was Muto and Nobuhiko Takada.
Takada, yeah.
And where they were like, it was the first kind of, that's where Eric Bischoff stole the NWO invasion storyline for WCW. Mm-hmm. He got it from watching this and how well it drew. Mm-hmm. And then, like, and All Japan was on fire this time with, like, your the four main guys, Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, and Tao.
That mid-90s period where they just changed everything around. It was like, we're doing clean finishes, and that heavyweight division, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find
a more lucrative time period. Yeah, and then... And now, I'd say it's better than it was like 10 years ago, but it's not the same. It's mainly because they don't have TV. They don't have TV on a national outlet, so it's harder for them to create stars and thus create box office attractions.
And the last one from Jay was, will there ever be a place in American wrestling beyond indie niche markets for talent such as Prince Devitt, Ibushi, Kenta, and Hiroshi Tanahashi in that style?
Prince Devitt, maybe. The other three, no.
I think Devitt is too good to not at some point get scooped by one of the main companies.
I see him more like going to TNA and working their X division. I mean, he's got charisma coming out of his ears.
Yeah.
You know? But I've never heard him cut a promo, so I have no idea if he can cut a promo for like WWE style and become a main eventer. And then his size works against him as well. So I see him more like becoming a star in TNA, if that's, you know, something people aspire to. But like, he's got a sweet deal. He's like a contracted wrestler for New Japan.
Yeah.
He's not like someone they just pay for per appearance. He's contracted to them. Like, he can't go anywhere until that contract runs out. So it's like Bernard and Carl Anderson. Like, they're contracted dudes over there. Mm. So like, I don't know if they want to try to possibly come over to WWE and try to make it or break it, as it were. And with Devitt, it works against him, his style and his size. So
that's why I see that this whole Sin Cara project is really interesting, because if this does take off and work, I don't know if it somewhat does kind of broaden their scope, or if it's just going to be the case that I think most are expecting that. I mean, he's going to be really pressured to work WWE style, and it's going to limit him getting over, and at some point they're just going to suddenly see this guy isn't getting over to the amount we're paying this guy. And
Now, if like WWE suddenly found like they got a huge pay-per-view market in Asia and in Ireland, then yeah, those guys, I could see them try to scoop up, like Tanahashi especially. Mm-hmm. They could like would they try to scoop, but like that's never gonna happen. I don't think, you know. If native wrestling in Japan isn't like that hot, I don't see how WWE is gonna become that hot over there either, because pay-per-view is not really a viable thing in Japan as it is.
Next question from Sam Kennerly. In regards to the pro-res model of wrestling, do you think it's healthier to the business to use inter-brand pay-per-views similar to Wrestle Kingdom, or have direct competition at all times?
I think 90% of the time it should be an isolationist policy. I don't think they should do too much inter-promotion, so that when they do it, it's more special and it thus draws more money.
Do you think it's somewhat fragmented though right now with all the offices that they have going?
Yeah,
in Japan, I think that was one of the bigger problems that they've run into over the past 10 years, is just talent being fragmented too much rather than having maybe two or three kind of solid bases where you have a bit more depth.
I would like to see one or two of the lower promotions just dissolve, and then like
Sasaki's promotion, for instance.
That doesn't count, because that's more he just takes his guys and then they go either work for All Japan or they go work for Noah right now. They're with Noah, so they're part of the roster anyways. I'm talking more like 0-1 or something like that. Take 0-1, that dissolves, so all these guys either go to like All Japan or New Japan, thus strengthening their rosters.
Have you seen that match with Hashimoto's kid yet? I think he's done like two matches. How's he looked? I haven't seen him yet.
He's green. He's okay. Like, I don't know. Who knows? Like, I would hope like he doesn't. They don't like try to push him to like, because he's
like what, 18?
Yeah, he's 18. He's built like not built, but he's not like his father. He's not built like his father. I hope they don't push him to like try to look like his father or anything like that. He's okay. I don't know. I don't think he has the charisma that his father has.
Yeah.
I mean, the hottest prospect in Japan is, and has been for the last 5 years, is Katsuhiko Nakajima.
Yeah.
You know.
Let's go over Rob King. I've never seen the whole Super J Cup event, but I have seen a few select matches. Sasuke El Samurai is about the best 10-minute match I've ever seen. The guy that shall not be mentioned had a couple of outstanding matches on that card, and the finals with Sasuke is a definite 5-star match. Seeing these matches really made me wish I'd been a bigger fan of Japanese wrestling growing up in the mid-90s.
Right. Okay, thank you, Rob. Next, we got Dennis Amai, who chose this show. Yes, Review Away picks one of my suggestions to review. Thanks, guys. I also haven't watched the whole event. I have only watched the last match, but the rest of the tournament is the best that I have ever seen. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Jushin Liger and Hayabusa had an awesome... Hayabusa had an awesome match. What a great career Hayabusa had. It's a shame he had to retire at such a young age. All the other wrestlers also looked great, especially Super Delphine. Eddie Guerrero, Black Tiger, also looked great in this tournament. I always thoroughly enjoyed his work in Japan and New Mexico. The Liger-Sasuke match is just phenomenal. The punishment that Sasuke can take is just insane. This show, I believe, has to be on par with WrestleMania X7, if not better. So many good matches, and this arguably is the show that put guys like Benoit and Malenko on the map. Would you agree with that?
No, well, put those guys beyond... No, they were on the map in Japan before.
Hmm.
This put the non-New Japan guys on the map. This put Sasuke and Delphine and Michinoku on the map. This put Ghetto on the map. Like
Ricky Fuji.
That's right. Team Canada.
This was his coming out party.
But no, one of the fallout from this tournament was that Michinoku Pro got a lot of press in the magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when wrestling was covered everywhere, like media outlets, like national newspapers,
mm-hmm.
national magazines. So like, and people probably never heard of it. Like, what the hell? This guy went to the finals. He beat Liger. Well, I gotta check it out. What's this Michinoku Pro? And people probably sought it out. And I think it coincided. Like at one point, like Michinoku Pro had the reputation of having like really good houses, not New Japan level arenas or anything like that, but they had really good houses and they had the best house shows. For like a 2-year period or something like that.
Yeah, and it's pretty timely as well because by the time people are listening to this past weekend was the King of Trios tournament that Chikara was holding in Philadelphia, and they were bringing in Team Michinoku Pro with Dick Togo, Jinsei Shinzaki, and Sasuke as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's at least Dick Togo was. It's his retirement tour.
Yeah.
So I mean. That's definitely a DVD you should seek out. It's one of the big highlights of the year on the indie calendar.
You talked about the success that the whole scene had following this tournament with the elevation of Sasuke and M-Pro. But could you imagine if Vince used that same mentality throughout the invasion, throughout however many opportunities he's had, even with Raw and SmackDown, you know?
No, I can't because like John and I were saying before, like Vince books for his ego, not for business. Like especially not during that WCW invasion thing. It's like, dude, you own these things. You own these guys. Like they're yours. So why do you think of them as your? You got to bury them.
it's such an odd concept, and it's so weird that here the mistakes we saw 10 years ago in the invasion. It's very interesting to see now with a mixed martial arts company like UFC pretty much in the same position right now,
mm-hmm.
and what they're going to do with their competition over the next 12 to 18 months. And I have more faith in a company that is, in a completely different situation, but how they view their competition. I mean, they're not looking at Strikeforce as this bastard child that is clinging on to UFC and is going to kill the heat of the UFC fighters.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Other thing I want to say with like with Michinoku Pro becoming popular for when it did, that actually I think in my opinion opened the door for like when Ultimo Dragon later created Toryumon, which has now evolved into Dragon Gate.
Yeah.
Like, and Dragon Gate is probably like number. I think it flows even between number 2 and 3 behind New Japan as like as far as like making money and having like. As many like passionate fans and like attendance and stuff like that. I mean, they always draw well.
It was amazing to see with Toryumon that as the Japanese scene really kind of went into a bit of a valley 10 years ago, that Toryumon sought out a completely different audience and were drawing their consistent 8,000 on a regular basis, and they never got to a gigantic level where they were filling a dome or anything, but they were never struggling at the gate either. I mean, they were just a very consistently run promotion. And did very well, and that eventually morphed into Dragon Gate.
So I think that's one of the results of like this tournament, and like, and then Jushin Liger made junior heavyweight wrestling a viable like box office draw.
Let's just finish off with one here. This one from Stephen Smith is way too long. Maybe we'll get to it next week. Mark Boric. Hey, John and Wei, I just heard Sunday's Review Away show, and the fact that you guys brought up how matches like the TLC have shortened careers and then Edge retiring on Monday night on Raw really hits home with how true that really is. And then Tough Enough, you see Miss USA staying and Matt Cross is gone. Talk about the get-out-of-jail-free card. I just hope that Bill DeMott kills her for the show of disrespect she showed in being late, like Austin said. Grammar is undervalued, I think. Anyway, not happy with Matt Cross being eliminated, and yes, Edge's retirement.
Need there we go. Do you follow Edge's career at all? Do you have any thoughts on Edge's retirement?
I he's like local guy who made good, and like I think Edge is probably the best like in-house creation that WWE has had in like the last 10 years. Like, here's a guy who made his name in the WWF, WWE, and then he evolved from like, you know, his various gimmicks when he started into like the Radar Superstar, and I was like, this guy, and he can do everything. He can work, he can cut promos, he's a good character on TV, and he's way more appealing as a character than 90% of their current roster. It's a big loss to them, in my opinion.
I think so as well. It's really weird to look back now, because I don't think anyone ever viewed Edge as the top guy in WWE, but you look back now at just how many different facets this guy provided for the company. And I was reading, Dave Meltzer had this stat about how over the past like 20 years or whatever, no one has had more four-star matches in either WWE or WCW during this entire time period than Edge. And he was just your consistent guy you could rely on to put in that spot. If someone went down, Edge was there. When SmackDown needed a face, he was there. And he's someone that I think really, really hurts them talent-wise right now at a time when they're trying to create all these new stars and failing at, with a lot of them right now.
I don't think John Cena would be where he is at this, at
that
this
was
point.
The feud to me that put Cena that as, put a, Cena as a main map, event talent. That was the feud where people stopped booing Cena. They were running into that problem at every pay-per-view, and then they put him with Edge for 6 months, and it was like everyone hated Edge. To me, that 2006 period, that was Edge's best year.
That's also Cena's best year.
That was Cena's
as
best
a character,
year.
Like, now I just can't stand watching him because he's just like, he doesn't take anything seriously, so why would I take him seriously? But like when he was fighting Edge, like, he was cutting, I think, the best promos of his career. He's having some of the best matches of his career. And then, you know, the fallout from that, and then following that, he had some great programs with other people. But now he just is horrible. But, like, that put him on the map. He would have got there. I'm not saying Cena wouldn't have got there without Edge, but he got there. He is where he is now because when he worked with Edge.
Do you think he goes into the Observer Hall of Fame this year Edge? Or even over the next 5 years?
Who, Edge?
Yeah.
When's he eligible?
He's already eligible. He got 18% last year.
He'll go in within 5 years. He'll be in. Yeah.
I have a feeling he will too, because I think you look at just the landscape right now. You're not getting a guy like that anytime soon.
No.
Coming out of your own developmental system, and it just seems that I think over the next 10 years, you're really going to see a bell curve downwards in terms of what is a strong worker.
You're going to have to – well, I mean, you have to take out the box office aspect of it if you want to include people from Japan. Like, it's not – no one draws over there as they used to. In terms of work, I mean, they're still, like, amazing workers.
So I'm talking more of the WWE model right now of what they're bringing up. I mean the guys like the Jerichos and the Edges and the Hunters, I mean, those guys are all, you know, pretty much their careers are definitely more years behind them than ahead of them.
The people who
point.
Are good workers are, I think, just going to get buried. In that company, like Brian Danielson. I refuse to use his slave name, just so you know.
His slave name.
I think...
He's an Apple now.
He's an Apple, that's right. I saw that. I read about that. But, like, people like that, because they don't work WWE style, they weren't created by WWE, I think they're doomed to failure unless they get a lucky break and someone just gets behind them. Someone in power just gets behind them.
And that's, you know, just going back to this show as we wrap up here, one of the things that I think made it so enjoyable was that you were taking all these bodies from these different offices and all had their distinct styles. And it was like, what's Hayabusa and Liger? What is that match going to look like? I know it's going to be really interesting and entertaining to watch, but here are two very different styles. And if you took 14 guys that are all working, quote unquote, WWE style, I just think there's so much to gain when you have a guy like a Bryan Danielson who can work this specific style with somebody else, and you're meshing these different styles, and there's that different flavor on the card rather than just one consistent style that everyone has forced upon them.
Almost begs the question, why bring in Mystico if you're not going to use Mystico like he's supposed to be used?
Wow. What a pessimistic end to this show, but a very, very good show nonetheless in the J-Cup 94. As we end off, Wei, next week, we were discussing this earlier, we're going to take a look at the very first ECW pay-per-view, Barely Legal, from 1997, and we're hoping to have a guest on next week that was involved with that show, but not confirmed right now, so we won't jinx it. But that's going to be coming up next
week. You have Taka Michinoku on the show?
Maybe we will. Yes, definitely. There is a Michinoku Pro influence on that show and a great six-man. So that's coming up next week, and we'll be back Tuesday with a review of Raw, and you can leave all your feedback on the Live Audio Wrestling Review Away Facebook group, and for all your news, go to liveaudiowrestling.com. Oh, Tune.
Tune. Well, I'm not going to leave it up to me, but you guys have all been introduced to WH on this podcast. What you probably don't know is that he is very much a music aficionado. So, WH, what are you listening to these days? And pick a song for us to go out.
Oh, my God. I don't know.
Putting you on the spot here.
It's putting me on the spot. I don't know. It's the last CD I listened to at work.
Your favorite song, whatever.
Right now, I like that song by Julian Casablancas. It's the first single from his solo record. Whatever that is.
The first track off his record.
No, the first single. I don't think it's the first track.
Oh, okay.
It's the first single off his solo record.
This will be fun to find.